Good morning and welcome back to Focus 580. This is hour number two of the program. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Jack Brighton is the producer. Harriet Williamson helping out this morning with production. Henry Frain at the controls. A quick mention that tomorrow morning on the show in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about how computers are increasingly now being used in the social sciences and the humanities. And our guest for the program will be Orville Burton. He's professor of history and sociology here at University of Illinois. In the second hour, the issue is gun regulation and public health. And look at the issue of guns as a public health matter. We'll have two guests, Sue Passion, who is Firearms Project Manager at the Consumer Federation of America, and also Brooke Anderson, a gun regulation organizer with a local organization here, the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the new science of networks. And our guest is Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He's professor of physics at University of Notre Dame. And for the past couple of years, he and his colleagues there have been doing research on complex networks. He has written about some of what they have found in a new book that's touching off a lot of interest. The title of the book is Linked, The New Science of Networks. And I think the subtitle really says it all. That is, how everything is connected to everything else and what it means for science, business, and everyday life. Perseus is the publisher of the book. And in the introduction to the book, he explains that the book has a simple aim to get you to think networks. It's about how networks emerge, what they look like, and how they evolve. Networks are present everywhere, he writes. All we need is an eye for them. And what he and his colleagues have found is that networks in the real world function rather differently than scientists had previously thought as they constructed models, thought about connections between the various elements of networks. They thought of them as being random, and in fact, they're not. He and his colleagues have discovered that they definitely follow rules and that you could see them operating in all kinds of situations, from everything from the global economy to the internet to the way diseases operate. So as we talk this morning with our guest, questions are certainly welcome. The number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, just so we can keep things moving along. But anyone who's interested in calling is welcome to join us. Professor Barabasi, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's pleased to be with you.
To begin, I think, to make certain that people know what it is we're talking about, we should just talk in very basic terms about the concept of a network and have a very basic definition. What is it that we're talking about? What is a network?
Sure. Well, I mean, like, the basic definition is anything is a network where you have a bunch of nodes connected by something which we typically call links. But the best is to really start with examples. You know, if you think about the society is nothing but the network of people connected by friendship, acquaintance links, or professional links. You know, so if I know my friend, there is an invisible link between us, essentially meaning I can always pick up the phone and call him and, you know, ask for a favor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you think of the whole society, we really have a very, very large network because every person has about, like, thousands of acquaintances, so therefore it's connected to 1,000 people. But there are many other examples of networks. I mean, if I think my body is, you know, we always think of being nothing more than a bag of chemicals. But those chemicals would not be really able to create life if they would not interact with each other. So I can go ahead and draw a map of the cell, for example, where every node is a chemical, and every reaction that connects to chemicals would be a link. The World Wide Web, you know, essentially the basic our big online library, is another network where the nodes are the web pages and the links are how, you know, the URLs that you can click and go from one web page to another one. And really, the reason why it's so wonderful these days, the World Wide Web, is because of the links, because the information is connected to each other and not just standalone information. And finally, the final example would be the reason you can understand what I'm saying is because our language is a network of words. The words are connected to each other by meaning, by various syntactical relationship. And these links are the one which make, you know, from just a dictionary of words, something that, you know, make communication possible, make language.
So before the work that you and your colleagues did, as I understand it, as people thought about networks, that is, these collection of points or nodes and the links between them, they made up models and they thought, okay, we'll start out, we'll construct a model network, we'll think, and then we can think about how that works. They made the assumption that the links between the nodes were random, and they, as they built their models, they would put nodes on a piece of paper, and they would make links between the nodes, and then they would look at how many links each node had, and some would have a few and some would have more, and that if you plotted then out on a graph the number of links particular nodes had, assuming that that's the way things worked, that you would end up with the classic bell curve distribution, and that the big sort of the big breakthrough that you and the people who work with you discovered was that in the real world, it's not like that at all.
That's correct. And just to step back a bit in history, that random network model was rooted really in the work of two Hungarian mathematicians, Paul Erdős, which many of your audience probably heard about him. He was this very eccentric mathematician who would leave out of a suitcase and travel from one university to another one, stay a few days, do some theorems, and move on. Mm-hmm. And his colleague and friend of Alfred Rainey. So they were the one who really proposed in the end of 1950s that since networks are so complex, and you know the use example of communications and living systems, and the networks appear to be so different from each other, the simplest way to describe them is to assume that they are random. And as you said, one of the consequences if I randomly put the links is that I will have a bell curve. Now, why is this a bell curve interesting? There is one point that I would like to emphasize here. A bell curve is really telling us that in a random network, most nodes have approximately the same number of links. It's really a mathematical formulation of the fact that it's very rare to find a node that would be very, very rich compared to the average node. So with a good approximation, you can assume that just about all nodes have roughly the same number of links. When we started looking into networks at the end of 1998, beginning of 99, well, we wanted to find an example of a large network that we could study, and we started with the World Wide Web. And essentially, what we did is that we wrote a bit of software that went out and created for us a web of the World Wide Web by going from page to page and returned this map to us. And indeed, as you mentioned, that there was a big surprise in that result, that this democratic network was not present at all. You know, that we expected that most nodes would have roughly the same number of links on the World Wide Web, but in contrast to that, what we found is that the majority of the pages on the World Wide Web had no or one or maybe two links to them, but there were a few pages that had thousands and thousands of them. Now, this extreme distribution, and particularly the existence of these very, very highly connected nodes, simply could not be reconciled with a random network worldview. But we really saw that on the World Wide Web, there are a few hubs, the hubs being these very highly connected nodes, that keep the whole network together. And some of these hubs are, I mean, most of these hubs are actually familiar to us. You know, they are Yahoo, they are Google, they are some of the big news organizations that have so many links to other sites and so many people link to them that you know, they appear as major hubs on the World Wide Web. But that was only one part of the story, that we found that on the World Wide Web there are these hubs. The real surprise came when people started to look, we and others started to look at other networks as well. So, for example, you can create a network of Hollywood actors by connecting any two actors together that play together in a movie. And some of your audience may be familiar with the Kevin Bacon game, or 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where the game asks the participant to connect any actor to Kevin Bacon via the movies in which they play together. So behind that game is really a very large, very, very densely interconnected network, what Hollywood really is. But when we looked at this network and we constructed the network since 1890 till today, we had all the actors and all the movies in there, What we found is that most actors had links to maybe 5-10 other actors, so they played in one movie with 5-10 other actors together. But there were a few actors that had thousands and thousands of links. So again, the same pattern emerged, that there were a few very, very highly connected hubs that kept the network together, kept Hollywood together. And these examples have been reoccurring in the last few days in many other networks. You know, we looked at the cell, how chemicals are connected to each other by reactions. And again, we found a few chemicals that have a very, very large number of links that appear to be the hubs of the cell. A group of scientists from Boston University and Stockholm has analyzed the data how people are connected by sexual relationship to each other, so always putting a link between two people if they had sex together. And what they found that in this network, most nodes, that is, most people had, you know, 5 to 10 links during the lifetime, meaning that they had 5 to 10 sexual partners during the lifetime. But there were a few people who had thousands of them. So the real surprise was that in the last few years we understood that this very inhomogeneous structure, which we kind of called scale-free network, scale-free network meaning that there's this coexistence of these very, very large nodes with many, many small ones, appear in just about any large network that is out there. So it seems to be a common architecture of complex systems.
Our guest, let me introduce again just very quickly, is Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He's professor of physics at University of Notre Dame and directs research on complex networks there. For several years now, the past few years, he and colleagues have been doing work on networks. And if you're interested in reading about it, you could take a look at his book, which is titled Linked, The New Science of Networks. Also, he has a webpage that I found just by putting his name into the web browser, but you can also go to www.nd for Notre Dame, www.nd.edu/networks/. And you will find it. And there are things like articles that he and his colleagues have written, talks they've given, news articles about it. So if you're interested in reading on this subject, you can go there to that page and look at various kinds of material. And, of course, you could also head out to the bookstore and buy Linked if you would like to read about it. And if you'd like to ask a question, of course, you can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So you discovered that this basic idea that previously the assumption had been that the links in networks were random, and that what you found out first by studying the web and then looking at other kinds of networks was in fact that they weren't that way at all, that most nodes, most of the points in the network have a small, relatively small number of links, but a few of them have a whole lot of links, and that's true of the internet, but it's also true of an awful lot of other kinds of networks. And we can talk about communication networks and economic networks and even biological networks. So then I suppose another question is, well, it seems that networks organize themselves that way. We see that pattern in all kinds of networks. So a natural question would be, why? Why are networks like that, and why are they not random like we thought perhaps they were?
That's right. That was obviously the next logical question. And it took us a few months, actually. We kept thinking about it. Why could that happen? And then finally we realized, you know, that we have to start from this very simple assumption of that networks are random and try to think what is wrong with that assumption. I mean, which part of that assumption may be failing in real systems? And one of the assumptions that goes into this random network worldview is that if I want to model a network, let's say, of the World Wide Web, and that has, let's say, 2 billion nodes, which is approximately the number right now, then what I should do is to go ahead and write on my, let's say, whiteboard these 2 billion nodes and randomly connect them. This may not seem to be a particularly big assumption, but there is an assumption hidden in it, that is, that I have available for me all the nodes in the model that I want to moment that I want to look at it. The truth is that really networks never popped up with 3 billion nodes. If you think about the World Wide Web, in 1991, it had only one web page. You know, Tim Berners-Lee, the World Wide Web's creator's first web page. And then people were discovering the medium, and they were adding new pages one by one, and essentially the network grew out from one page to have over 2 billion pages today. And so essentially what we find, if you look at the world, what we find is that the network emerged by growth. But that pattern is present in just about all networks if you think about it. In Hollywood, you know, in 1890, there were only a handful of actors playing in silent movies. And as new actors joined the trade, as Hollywood became bigger and bigger, so did the network, slowly increased from a dozen actors to today over 500,000 actors. And if you think about ourselves, you know, originally about 3 billion years ago, we just had a few chemicals going on randomly on Earth. And the prevailing view is that essentially new and new chemicals were synthesized and the chemical network has grown to become a cell and to become larger and larger and more complicated cells. So if you think about evolution, that's a growth process from a few chemicals to larger and larger and more complex molecules. And just about any network out there, if you look at them, you will find this pattern that they started out with a few nodes and they grew out of them and became to what we see today. So growth is a very essential property of networks, and we should not model networks such that we assume that we have all the nodes available. That was one thing which was missing from the random network models. But there was another key element which was necessary to explain these hubs. That is, when a new node comes into the network, the random worldview assumes that it connects randomly to any of the nodes that are out there. If you think about real networks, that is not the case. When you create a new web page and you would like to connect somewhere, you know, let's say to some news outlet, you will not pick any page out there that would have news in it. You know, you would go to the pages that you are familiar with, and, you know, you'd go to New York Times, CNN, or so on, or NPR, and what you'll be really connecting to are the pages that have a large number of links in the first place, because those are the pages that you are familiar with. So you have to realize there are 2 billion pages out there on the World Wide Web. Any single person is familiar with a tiny fraction of them. But most of us are familiar with the hubs, with the highly connected nodes. So whenever we decide to connect somewhere, we connect to the sites that we are familiar with, and that includes an immediate bias towards the more connected nodes, because those are more visible, we are more acquainted with them. So a new node on the World Wide Web, and it creates a new link, it does not create that link randomly, but it prefers to connect to the more connected nodes. It doesn't always do that. Sometimes we connect to our friend's web page, which may not be that connected. But in general, there is a preference. This is what we call preferential attachment towards the more connected nodes. And the same pattern is present again in other networks as well. You know, in Hollywood, if you are an actor that has thousands of links, more likely than compared to other actors, you will be chosen for another movie because simply you are visible, you are well known to the audience, and directors want to employ you essentially to bring in the audience. So if you look around in just about any network, you will find that there is always a bias to connecting to the more connected nodes. The bias from one network to another one may have a different origin, but that bias is present. So now you have a network which is growing. Always a new node is coming in, and the new nodes prefer to connect to the more connected nodes. And what you find is there is a more highly connected node out there that they connect to. That will grow faster than the less connected nodes. So there is what we call a rich get richer phenomena. The rich nodes acquire more links during time because they are more visible and will leave very much behind the less connected, less rich nodes. And this mechanism is the one which seems to be responsible in most of the networks for the emergence of these hubs, for these very, very highly connected nodes. What is interesting, though, is that the word scale-free network that I used earlier to describe these hub-dominated networks also implies that there is not a single hub in these networks. There is always a hierarchy of hubs. There is a most connected node. Let's say that would be Yahoo right now on the web. And there are a few that are very close to it, you know, Google and some other search engines that are almost as connected but not quite. And there are even more that are a bit less connected. And as you go to the rest and less connected nodes, you find more and more of them. So when I say that there are hubs in these networks and they emerge as rich gets richer phenomena, I don't really mean that they're going to form a separate group. They form a continuum from a few very highly connected nodes to the many, many, many nodes with a few connections only. And that's what really the scale-free term means. And really behind this structure that we see in these different networks appears to be this rich gets richer phenomena.
Now, this points at a potential weakness in the scale-free network. If networks were random and we started to take out particular nodes, the consequences for the entire network would be small. But if we have a network, a scale-free network, and we have certain nodes with many, many links, then if we take out one of the nodes with lots of links, if we take out a hub, then the consequences to the network are very, very significant. And sort of the model that one can think of is the way airlines now operate, where so many of them connect through major hubs. If a small airport, say, for example, our airport here in Champaign-Urbana, if for some reason it was not operating, the consequences to air travel wouldn't be so big. But if O'Hare somehow wasn't operating, then air travel in the entire country and in the world, perhaps, might be affected.
That's right. And let me actually start with the better news, not necessarily with the bad news. And first of all, the airline analogy is a very good one. If I always suggest people, if they want to think about this scale-free network, they should think about the airline system, where indeed there are many, many tiny airports, such as the South Bend Airport, which is serving the Notre Dame community here. But they're all connected through a few hubs, such as La Chicago's O'Hare. And, you know, and that airline example also gives you an idea of why the hubs are important, because in a hub-dominated network, every time you want to travel from one node to another one, you have to go through the hub. So hubs play a very central role in keeping the network together. But regarding the issue that you just brought up about their fragility or their sensitivity to attacks, let me start with the better news there. And the better news is that, you know, we know that many networks are very robust against failures. And what do I mean by that? On the Internet, at any moment, there are a few hundred routers that are not functioning. They're simply just broken down. They're going to fix it in a few minutes or in a few hours or a few days, but at the moment, they're broken down. Yet, the whole network does not fail as a result. So you can have several hundred routers not working, and yet there's still the whole network to be functional, to be able to send emails and communicate. There's a similar robustness in our body. At any moment that I'm talking to you, there are hundreds or perhaps thousands of mistakes in my body. You know, there are mutations from one cell to another one when cells multiply. There are misfolding proteins. There's lots of other mistakes going on. Yet, I'm not dropping that any moment such a mistake happens. Somehow, my body ignores and those errors. What we call is that it's robust against such local errors. So what we see as a general pattern, that complex systems, particularly network systems, are very robust against random failures. If a component randomly goes down, not much will happen. Now, what it turns out that indeed the network topology plays a very important role. So when we investigated how do these scale-free networks respond to these random breakdowns, well, we learned that indeed you can knock out a very high fraction of the nodes from the network, and the network will not break apart. This is not true for a random network. A random network, if you knock out a critical fraction of the nodes of the network, will break into tiny islands that don't communicate with each other. On a scale-free network, you can knock out 80% of the nodes. Mm. And the remaining 20%, they will be still together in a cluster, and they will be able to communicate to each other. And that's what we call that the scale-free networks have a built-in topological robustness. Their structure offers them robustness against random error. And as you said, the reason why these networks are robust is because they are held together by the hubs. And when random errors occur, most of the time, since there are many, many small nodes, they will be affecting the small nodes. Very rarely, you now randomly knock out the hub because there are so few of them. And therefore, you know, if you knock out a small node, it will not matter for the network and will continue to be functional. But the price of this phenomenal robustness is indeed, as you mentioned, in the ability of the network to withstand attacks. So if I know which are the hubs and I go and take out the hubs one by one, the network will be very easily breaking into pieces. And that has very important consequences. You know, we know that the Internet is a scale-free network. Here, I mean, the computers connected to each other by routers and physical lines. That's right, the Internet that I'm talking about. And that really means is that there are a few very highly connected nodes or hubs that keep the network together, and one of them being actually in Chicago. The most connected hub in the United States is in a suburb of Chicago. Now, if somebody knows who are these hubs, and that's public knowledge, you can go ahead and knock 5 or 10 of them out, and the network will break into pieces that cannot communicate with each other. So the Internet, while it's very robust against random errors, just breakdowns of components, it's very fragile against well-directed attacks. If somebody knows what's doing, it could actually take them out. The same is true for the cell. You know, the cell, when we looked at how the protein interact with each other, what we found is that you can knock out a very high fraction of the proteins from the cell and not affect its behavior. But if you take out some of the most connected hubs, the cell will right away die. So some of the most connected proteins, in the absence of the most connected proteins, the cell will not survive. So what we really see now is that networks have this, we call Achilles heel property, this double feature, that they are very robust against random failures, but they are very fragile against attacks. And this is certainly bad news. For example, the fragility is bad news for the Internet, because indeed it gives an avenue for hackers to, if they want to break down the whole network. But it's good news for biology, because in biology we don't really have attacks, you know, like design attacks against cells. But we could design drugs based on this principle that would attack some of the hubs of some of those, let's say, bacteria that are not desired in the human body, for example.
Well, that's interesting, and I guess it is a little comforting if you think about the fact that if you're going to design a system and look at what is the most likely threat, that in nature probably random attack, random errors are indeed more of a problem than targeted ones, and so if you have to take your choice, maybe it makes more sense to design a system that will deal well with random errors, because then it seems that targeted attack rather often, or at least with the kind of networks that we're talking about now, there are going to be a human agent at work. So there again, you have to design some other sort of.
Sure, you're absolutely right. So there's no reason for nature to kind of prepare itself against against well-designed attacks, because any system has vulnerabilities. So any defense could be actually fought off. It's really the most sense what it makes for any natural system is to somehow evolve into a state which is very robust against inevitably random errors.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Albert Lazzo-Barbasi. He's professor of physics at University of Notre Dame and directs research there on complex networks. And we are talking about that, the new science of networks, and how he and his colleagues there, over the last few years, have really changed the way we think about networks and added to our understanding of how they work. And also part of the idea is here to get people thinking about networks. And once you do that, he says, that you're going to start to see them everywhere. And knowing all of that and having a better understanding of the way networks work will perhaps give us a better understanding of the way the world works. And if you're interested in reading about this, again, you can take a look at his book, Linked, The New Science of Networks. It's published by Perseus Publishing, is in bookstores now, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers coming in to join the conversation, so we will start in with someone here in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Could you speak to the issue of redundancy in these complex systems? I recognize they're very robust, but how much of the robustness is a function of redundancy?
Sure. Well, this is a wonderful question, and that was one of the things that really occupied us at the beginning. And let me, just for those of you who may not be familiar with redundancy, probably you mean the fact that there are certain functions that can be carried by different parts of the network and or different links. I mean, there are several paths between any pair of nodes, and
yes,
that could contribute to the redundancy. One of the things you may want to realize is that random networks are just as redundant as these scale-free networks, and probably even more so, because the scale-free networks are so much relying on the hubs is that some of the redundancy is taken away from them, because of the very important role of the hubs. So when it comes to redundancy, random networks, you know, have an equal degree of redundancy as the scale-free networks. Yet, random networks are not robust against random failures, because every random network has a well-defined, what we call, critical threshold. If you knock out more nodes than that critical threshold, you know, like, let's say, the critical threshold could be, let's say, 20%. If you knock out randomly more than 20% of the nodes, the network will break into non-communicating islands. And that's a very well-known result from both from the network theory community and for what we call the percolation theory community. What is interesting about the scale-free network is that the threshold for the scale-free network is 1. That is, you have to knock out all the nodes to break the network into pieces. So simply, they refuse to break apart. And so that's really where the difference comes in, that yes, regarding the redundancy, they have an equal response. You know, they have an equal degree, perhaps, of redundancy when it comes to random or scale-free network. But in a random network, the random breakdown of nodes will break the network into pieces. In a scale-free network, it does not. And this is not only a quantitative answer, but there have actually been proofs now in the literature to show that the threshold for a scale-free network is exactly 1, which means that you have to knock out all the nodes to break the network into pieces.
Can we take this one step farther? I know in biological systems, one of in ecological systems in particular, one of the assumptions is that perturbations to the system, some disruption of the system, increases diversity.
Uh-huh.
Does that occur in, do you see the same phenomenon occur in things like the Internet, World Wide Web?
Probably not exactly in the same language. You see, the issue of diversity is really very, very specific issue to biological systems, and particularly to ecological systems. And you know, I certainly don't want to mislead you. There are lots of other reasons why some systems are robust. You know, there is what we call a dynamical robustness. There's what we call there are feedback loops in every system that dynamically try to correct any errors. And biological systems have very much such a feedback loop. Like in the cell, if a concentration of a chemical goes very much up, a few other reactions would turn in to shut it down, essentially, so that it cannot kill the cell. And those are some kind of dynamical rules. The surprising effect, perhaps, and the new thing over here, is that we never expected that the network topology would also play a role. So in addition to these dynamical feedback mechanisms that contribute to robustness, both in ecological and biological and systems and on the Internet, there is this topological feature. Now, I don't have a clear answer to your questions about diversity, and one of the reasons is that simple discussion has not been addressed in the terms of the Internet. And if you want to give some explanation why not, is that you have to realize that the concept of scale-free network was introduced to us in 1999, and this is a fairly young science. You know, there has been several 100 papers in the literature in the last 3 years about the subject, but very, very many questions are just beginning to be asked. And one of the areas which has not been, too much covered in the literature is the ecological systems and really the impact of ecological network structure on the ecological systems. And there are several reasons for that. One of them is that some of the ecological maps are very poorly mapped. One of the best maps we have available in ecological systems of how species are connected are the food webs. And the reliable food webs contain at most 100 nodes, 100 species, which is very small for a detailed analysis.
Sure.
So I would say that when it comes to ecological systems, some of these questions are just beginning to be asked, and perhaps in a few years we're going to have answers in that language that you are asking, but right now I'm afraid I don't have one.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, and we'll continue. The next caller is also in Urbana and line 2. Hello.
Yeah, I was hoping I could find out more about the way you characterize the Internet. When you say that there are these certain hubs, how many would you say there are?
Yes, that's a wonderful question, and I guess many people who work with the Internet would like to know who are the hubs. I'm not going to have a good answer to that, and the simple reason is in the term scale-free. What the scale-free means, really, is that there is no intrinsic scale in the system that would allow me to distinguish the nodes from each other, saying, from here on, I'm going to call you guys hubs, and from nodes that are smaller than this scale, they will be not hubs. What we have in the Internet as well, that we have, you know, a few nodes that have, you know, a few hundred links, and a few routers that have a few hundred links, and then we have a larger number that have like dozens, and then even larger that have, you know, a few, and then even larger that have one. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a continuum between the most connected, very few, to the very little connected, many, many nodes. And there is no scientific basis by which we can assign saying, from here on, you are hub. Before that, you know, if you're smaller than this threshold, you are not a hub. And this is very much in contrast with the random network concept, because in the random network, as was mentioned in the beginning of this discussion, they have a Bell-type distribution, which means that there is an average node in the system, and I could refer everything back to the average node, saying if you are much larger than the average, then you are perhaps a hub. If you are much smaller, then you are not. Since we don't have an average node and in this type of networks, I mean, average does exist, but it doesn't. It's not particularly meaningful because of the nature of the distribution. We cannot scientifically assign a threshold saying from here on we call hubs. So it really depends on your personal view of what you would blame as being hubs, or what you would call as being hubs. All I can tell you, what these relations allow me to tell you is that given the size of the network, I can tell you how many nodes will have, let's say, 1,000 links. I can tell you how many nodes will have 100 links, and I can tell you how many nodes will have a few links. So I have a predictive power to tell you what is really the size distribution. I don't have a predictive power saying from where on you should consider it as something as being hub.
Well, what about percentiles? What would be how many nodes would there be in the top one percentile as far as
what? Okay. Well, this is the what we're really talking about is behind the scale free networks is there's a concept we call a power load distribution. So the number of links a node has that follows really a power law. And power laws are something which reoccur in many other systems, and there is this very popular concept called the 80-20 rule. And essentially what the 80-20 rule tells us in a lay language that the system has a power law distribution, and it's typically used, hey, 80% of the crime is done by 20% of the links, the very percent of the delinquents, let's say, the percent of the population, and so on. So there are many examples of the 80-20% rule. Something that like that applies to the World Wide Web, for example. I don't remember the internet numbers. I remember that on the World Wide Web, about 90% of all the links belong to 10% of the sites. So 90% of the incoming links, that the popularity links, really are distributed only along 10%. A very similar number should be applying to the internet. And, you know, if you go to our website and look up some of the papers, you will probably find the raw data that would allow you to find the precise ratio, but it should be around 90-10.
So 10% of 2 billion is what you're saying?
That's right. In the World Wide Web case, yes, 10% of the 2 billion nodes would contain about 90% of all the links that are out there.
And you're saying that if you targeted the, for example, maybe this 10% is wrong, maybe it's right, who knows, but if you targeted these hubs,
yeah,
you could bring down the system at some point?
Well, now, let's of course, make a distinction between the World Wide Web and the Internet. When I said the 90-10%, that essentially I was referring to the World Wide Web. That's where I remember the numbers.
Okay.
The World Wide Web is a virtual network of web pages connected by URLs. And then there's the Internet, which is the physical network. Now, if you go ahead and target the World Wide Web nodes, you're not going to bring down the Internet. You will shut down a website. And that's what happened with the Mafia Boy attack. On the other hand, if you target the Internet nodes, then you could indeed shut down the network. Now, how many of those Internet hubs you have to knock out, that's a good question. Now, current maps of the Internet contain about 250,000 routers. So that's the size of the system we are talking about on the Internet case, on the physical infrastructure case. And the question is, what is the threshold? And what we found when we did the simulations on this is that in order to break the Internet into pieces by attacks, you have to knock out a bit less than 5% of the nodes. Mm. That may seem like a lot, but that's misleading. And I think you can actually achieve the same thing by knocking out much fewer than that. And why is that? Because once you knock out the biggest node, there will be a rerouting of all the packages that are sent to that node to other routers because that node is not functional anymore. That router is not functional. And automatically, the stuff will actually go to other routers. If you knock out five or six bigger routers, all these packages will be going to the tiny routers, well, much smaller routers, and essentially you're creating a denial of service attack on the smaller one. So if you factor in dynamical features of what's really how the routing is done and how the packages are sent, you don't need to knock out 5% of the nodes from the Internet, but a much smaller percentage would achieve the same effect.
Oh, I'll just have one more question if I could. I was wondering if there's a lot of discussion about how the media keeps concentrating into a few networks, and I guess there you're talking about communication of messages. Is there anything you could say about what about that, or is that too small a system? Does it look to you like it might in the future degenerate into just one hub, or is there any hope for it staying, as diverse as possible, et cetera, if you get my point?
Just to make it clear to me, I faded out your voice in a second.
I'm sorry.
You mean that the network, the media as a network?
Yeah, with Time Warner, Disney, Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
Everybody's complaining about the concentration.
Sure. So, and you mean like essentially the globalization and other effects are concentrating the power in more and more into a few hands.
A few hands. Is there anything you could say about that, or is that too small a system?
If you want to concentrate only on the media, that's a too small system.
Right.
But don't concentrate on the media. Concentrate on the world economy. And consider every company as being one node and the different links between them as being different selling, buying relationship, business relationship that we have between them. And if you look at that perspective, then you can start drawing some conclusions. And one of the things I mentioned, precisely as an answer to your question, is that if you have a scale-free network, I can tell you, depending on the size of the network, how many hubs we're going to have and how many smaller nodes and how many tiny nodes. And people who looked at the different aspects of networks in economy, they found, again, the scale-free topology. What this really means is that there are many, many smaller companies, and there are fewer and fewer large companies, and there will always have the very, very connected node over there. What is interesting is that we expect that these distributions to be certainly stationary. But if the network is growing, that is, for example, there is globalization, which opens the media market out not to be interested only in U.S., but they can go to Mexico, Canada, and Europe, or other countries, then the size of the network has increased. And with that, the size of the hubs must increase as well, because that's what we call a scale-free relationship. As the network increases, so do the hubs in a proportional fashion. So in many ways, you can view this big agglomeration of power as being a natural consequence of globalization, natural consequence of the fact that the network has increased. And in order to maintain this scale-free feature, it has to increase its biggest hubs. So that would be like a naturalistic explanation saying, essentially the economy is a network. It's all about relationship between different companies. And it's a growing network, because we consume more and more and we bring other countries up to consume more and more. And as a result, you will develop these hubs. If the network is constrained on a smaller country, the hubs will be smaller. Larger the territory over which you let the players to operate, larger the largest nodes would be.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller I'd like to try to include.
Sure.
They are also in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, I believe I heard Professor Barabasi say that network analysis was a new science. However, I think the study of networks goes back to the 30s and 40s. People have been working on network analysis, specifically social network analysis, for the last 70 years.
Uh-huh.
Professor Barabasi has done that's relatively new, has studied things on a much larger scale. But the idea of studying networks is quite old, and researchers at places like Harvard and University of California, Irvine, and MIT have done wonderful stuff over the years in network analysis. And furthermore, the study of structure at these levels is something that perhaps Professor Barabasi could learn from by looking at what's been done on a smaller scale.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sorry if I give you the wrong impression saying that when I give a talk, I always tell people, hey, don't you think that I'm coming here to tell you that I discovered networks? That by no means has happened. Well, let me tell you probably what is actually perhaps the new. Indeed, there has been lots of work in social sciences, and if you read Linked, then I discuss the work of Stanley Milgram, Margaret Wetters, and other sociologists in this area. And I should mention that one of the most well-known social science network groups is actually in Urbana right now, Professor Wasserman's groups, and he has one of the most classic books in this area of social network analysis. But there has been still in the last few years a very significant change, and that came not with, you know, a bunch of physicists and mathematicians getting into the game and feeling smarter than anybody else, but simply by the availability of data. What has not been available in the 1940s and 50s, and not until the last few years, is really data on very, very large networks. We didn't have a World Wide Web. The largest network the sociologists had a chance to study was at most a few hundred nodes. What we have learned is that some of these features, like the scale-free network topology and many other features, are simply not visible if you look at a very small network. So in the last year, since everything is becoming computerized, we started to get data on how the World Wide Web looks like, how actors are connected in Hollywood to each other because people created websites listing all their movies, data about biological reactions have been connected into websites. Before it was scattered all along the literature, now you can find it into databases. And this wealth of data has offered the possibility for us and many others to go and look and ask other questions that could have not been asked essentially before with much smaller data sets. And that's what really has created a lot of excitement. And indeed, the community to a certain degree is aware of the sociologists' work, and we very much incorporate some of their ideas. But some of the questions we are asking at this point are questions that are quite different from what has been asked before, simply because we have the data available to ask those questions. I hope this answers your question.
And unfortunately, we don't really have much time left, but the next interesting set of questions is what sort of practical applications do we have for this sort of new, if we do understand networks in a way that we did not before, we have a better understanding how they work, then how do we apply that knowledge?
Well, there are many levels. I mean, the first level of application, of course, is that gives you a new conceptual way of thinking about it, and that often leads to practical ideas of how to use them. But I should mention one area where this has already led to a quite different understanding, and it has already an impact on how we look at things, and that is the spread of computer and biological viruses. You see, for many years, epidemiologists and many others have actually worked on the area of how viruses are spreading, whether we talk about AIDS spreading from one person to another one through sexual intercourse, or we're talking about how computer viruses spread from one computer to another one. And the basic assumption was that if a virus is not particularly virulent, that is, it's very hard to get it, very hard to pass it from one person to another one, then the virus will die out. If the virus is above a certain threshold, its virulence is above a certain threshold, then it will spread and reach just about all nodes. And these threshold constants have been very important for really, essentially stopping epidemics, because the reason why we are asked to use condoms is partly because potentially it's going to save the individual who is using the condom from AIDS. But we also decrease the spreading rate of AIDS. And the theory behind it is that potentially AIDS could die out if enough people use condoms. Now, we know that the AIDS is not dying out, but is actually spreading at a larger and larger rate. And two physicists essentially from Trieste have offered an explanation about 2 years ago that has gotten lots of attention. What they have shown is that this concept that the virus will die out if it's not too virulent is true if the network is random. On a scale-free network, it's not true. On a scale-free network, even extremely weakly virulent viruses will spread and reach a very high percent of the nodes. So the threshold is really not scale-free network, is zero. Now, why is this important? Because most of the networks on which viruses are spreading are scale-free. You know, computer viruses are spreading on the email network of who knows whom on the email, and there has been a study from Germany about a year ago showing that that has a scale-free topology. AIDS is spreading on a sexual network of who's had sex with whom, and there has been this Boston University Stockholm joint study where they showed that essentially is a scale-free network. Yeah.
My apologies for interrupting you. I'm very sorry to have to do that because you haven't quite made your point, but we're going to have to stop because we have used our time. And first of all, we want to say, Professor Bahabazi, thank you very much. And also to people who are listening, if you'd like to read more on this, you can look for this book we've talked about. Linked is the title by our guest, Albert Laszlo Bahabazi from Notre Dame. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Indeed, the rest of the story is in the book.
All right.